this is a lesser known case that has made a huge impact in finding killers and solving cases across the U.S. It starts with Katie Sepich, a vibrant, smart, beautiful young college student who was kidnapped and raped before her deranged killer left her body in a city dump.
I just kept hoping it wasn't her. I kept hoping it was someone else. And he said, when they pulled back that sheet, he said, I just fell to my knees. And he said, I just asked God, take me too. I don't want to live anymore.
That's Jayann Sepich, Katie's mother, talking about how her husband collapsed after identifying her daughter's body. We talk about the case and how her daughter lives on today and what the killer told her when they were face to face after he was finally caught.
I wanted to talk to him to try to find out why he would have done that to my daughter.
Before we dive into the case, I want to remind you that this is for mature audiences and still might not be for everyone. After the episode, I have a shout out for investigators who wrote reviews on Apple Podcasts. Thank you. It really helps independent podcasts like this one get noticed. More on that after the case. The murder of Katie Sepich. Investigators, you're on Deadline.
From the social distancing studios in Las Vegas, Nevada, to your ear holes, this is True Crime Deadline, a podcast discussing cold cases, murder, mysteries, and completely random thoughts. Now your host, a man who sings happy birthday twice when washing his hands, Mr. Mystery himself, Matt Johnson.
And thank you, Mr. Announcer Man, and thank you, investigators, for joining me for episode 30, The Murder of Katie Sepich and the DNA Saves nonprofit founded by her mother. This case takes us to a place I know pretty well, Las Cruces, New Mexico. So here's the deal. In 2002, after I graduated from college, I sent out 100 VHS resume tapes with college stand-ups of me in a big suit jacket that I bought at the Goodwill store. I was doing my best to look like the news reporters I grew up watching in Los Angeles. And it's shocking to know, might be, that out of those 100 VHS reels, I only got one call back. And I took the job. I was hired as a bureau reporter for the local CBS station in Farmington, New Mexico. But first, I needed to go to training. So I packed up my U-Haul and I drove to Roswell, New Mexico, where there I met the CBS crew who trained me on how to use the camera and all the editing equipment. KBIM Roswell is where I worked. They serve southern New Mexico, the land of enchantment. It's a picturesque place, magical according to the Native Americans who have lived on the land for thousands of years. And this is the part of America that has painted sunsets, caverns with stalactites. And when you buy a hamburger there, they ask you if you want green or red chili. It's a thing. It's great. Southern New Mexico borders Texas, Arizona, and the country of Mexico. It's home to the Holloman Air Force Base, Roswell, Carlsbad, and Las Cruces, and that's where this story takes place. Las Cruces is a town of 220,000 people, located along the Rio Grande, 4 hours from El Paso, Texas, 23 from Tucson, Arizona, and 15 from Roswell. It's a place rich in culture, but at the same time, it's also small town USA. And it's where Katie Sepich was living in 2003, attending New Mexico State University. I recently had the opportunity to speak with her mother, Jayann, via Skype. Take a listen.
My name is Jayann Sepich, and Katie Sepich was my daughter.
Tell me about her.
Katie was a force of nature. Katie was, she always got her way. We called her the Velvet Steamroller because she just pretty much always got what she wanted, but she did it in such a way that people just loved her anyway. We called her the Schmoozer. She was also the planner. She was very bright. She was hilariously funny, and she just loved fiercely. And I think, I know, that's what I miss the most about her, was that she so fiercely loved, you know, those people in her life that were important to her. And if you were lucky enough to be one of those people, you just felt the warmth and the protectiveness of her love always.
Yeah, what was going on in her life? She was really smart. She was going to New Mexico State, correct?
She had just started working on her Master's of Business Administration. She had just, in May, she graduated with a degree in business with a specialization in marketing, and she'd started working on her MBA. And she, the last time I talked to her about what she wanted to do with that, she said, "Oh, Mom, I don't know yet. I really don't know, but I'm going to change the world." And I thought she would. You know, she was just, I said, she set goals and she made them happen.
Talk to me about that time in her life. She's also dating someone. She has roommates or a roommate. Walk me through her life.
Well, Katie always had at least one job, sometimes two. She was very, very ambitious. And so she had, at that point, she was working at a Mexican food restaurant as a server, and she was working on her MBA. Her boyfriend, his name was Joe, and he had graduated and had moved back to his hometown, which was Gallup, New Mexico. So she was in Las Cruces at New Mexico State, and he was home in Gallup. And so that Labor Day weekend, I wanted her to come home, and she wanted to stay because Joe was coming down for the weekend. So she wanted to stay in Las Cruces.
On August 31st, 2003, the start of Labor Day weekend that year, and exactly 17 years to the day of this podcast episode being published, 22-year-old Katie Seppich was leaving a party after getting into a big fight with her boyfriend. She left behind her cell phone, her keys, her purse. She was that angry. And unfortunately, that was the last time her friends and family would see her alive. Her body was found the next day in the Las Cruces landfill after her roommate reported her missing. Katie had been strangled, sexually assaulted, and her body partially burned. Her boyfriend was called in for questioning right away, but also cleared. Now, despite police working round the clock, having DNA evidence and physical evidence in the case, it would be years before it would be solved. What do we know about that night? Like, what happened?
Well, we know that she worked her shift at the restaurant, and then after the shift was over, she went home and showered and changed, and a lot of friends went out. They went to a bar for a while, and then they ended up at a friend's house. And while they were there, she and Joe got into an argument, a very heated argument. And Katie just got furious and just decided to walk home. And it was about five blocks from there to her house, very safe neighborhood. But she was so angry that she left without her purse, without her keys. She didn't take her car. She just walked home. And she never, no one ever saw her again after she walked out of that house.
Yeah, this is a very surprising area for anything to happen. I'm familiar with the area. I worked in New Mexico for KRQE, News 13, for a while. And so that's like an upper scale area. It's not too far from the university. One person would feel safe, like just walking down the street by themselves. So, you know, she gets upset. She leaves her items there, her keys, her phone, what have you. And she thinks that nothing's going to happen. No one would think anything's going to happen to them.
No, I never worried about her living in that neighborhood. You know, we really searched to help find some place that we felt she would be really safe. And I never worried about that neighborhood. And when I found out she was missing, I was, of course, just absolutely frantic and surprised. You know, it was such a shock.
And it was her roommate. She had noticed that she didn't come home the night before, or at least she wasn't there in the house. And so she starts calling, you know, police precincts. She starts calling the hospitals in the area. She calls all the friends, and then she calls you. Do you remember that?
I remember it like it was 5 minutes ago. We were getting ready for this big, you know, backyard party, and we had a house full of out-of-town friends that had come, and all of our in-town friends were getting ready to come over. It was 2:15, and I woke up that morning with a really weird feeling in the pit of my stomach, and all day I'd been kind of anxious, but I didn't know why. And when I answered the phone and Tracy said, "Jan, have you talked to Katie today?" I knew something was horribly wrong. I knew that feeling that I had, you know, was real, that something had really happened. And course, this was in 2003. This was before texting. But Katie called me usually at least once a day, sometimes three and four times a day. So when I hadn't talked to her at 2:15 in the afternoon, I already was a little concerned. And then combined with that feeling, I just knew something wasn't right.
And then when was it that you had learned that the worst had happened, that you lost her?
We told Tracy to file a missing persons report, and she did. And Dave got in our car and headed out for Las Cruces to, you know, go see what we could do. And when he got to her house, there was the sheriff and a chaplain and a victim's advocate. And they told him that that morning, target shooters out in the desert had found a body and that he needed to go to the morgue and identify her.
And I understand, and I'm sorry that some of this is tough to relive and go over, but it's important for her story and, you know, how she lives on later and now. So I apologize and thank you. I thought that, you know, watching another interview clip with you and your husband, when Dave was talking about when he identified Katie, what happened during all of that, he fell to his knees, and I thought that that was just so powerful.
Well, when he got home that night, he got home about 1 a.m. and he walked in and he told me, he said, "That's the hardest thing I've ever done." He said, "I just kept hoping it wasn't her. I kept hoping it was someone else." And he said, when they pulled back that sheet, he said, "I just fell to my knees." And he said, "I just asked God, take me too. I don't want to live anymore." And I mean, no father should ever, ever have to experience that. It just broke my heart for him that, you know, you see it in movies, but that it was real. I still think of how horrible that had to have been for him.
And that you guys still live with this today. I mean, every day you wake up and you miss her every day. And you wonder what her life would be like at this moment. You know, you're a mother, you know?
And she had such promise. And she was, like I said, she was just a force of nature. I just knew that she was going to do great things. And not only that, we just miss her. You know, my youngest daughter got married June 6th. And we missed her. You know, she should have been there. She should have been with us, and that was hard, but I believe she is with us. You know, I really do.
I usually ask this at the end, but since we're here and we're talking about it, you know, what do you talk about with her now? Like, do you have conversations with her? What do you talk to her about?
All the time. The first thing I do in the morning is I go out on my back patio and I talk to God and I talk to Katie. And when I walk out on that patio, I always say, "Good morning, God. Good morning, Katie," you know, And I know it sounds a little unbelievable, but I have heard her voice on several occasions. And it's always been, it's always been kind of important, but it really hasn't. One time my curling iron broke and I didn't want to spend the money to get another one because it was kind of an expensive curling iron and I was very unhappy. And I heard her voice say, "Mom, go look at my stuff. You got me one for Christmas. You know, just like it." And sure enough, that was true. But I wasn't thinking about her in that moment. You know, I was thinking about, dadgummit, I don't want to have to spend the money for a new curling iron. And I heard her voice. So, but I have also heard her voice when it's been kind of important too.
That's amazing. That's great that you're able to, you know, have that connection and you're able to listen. You know, that's a gift. That's awesome.
Well, the first time I heard it was in the week after she died, before they had finished the autopsy, so before we could have the funeral, and we were getting literally hundreds of cards, of sympathy cards. And I couldn't read them, but I was opening them and just slitting them open and looking at the return address to see who they were from. And I just said to her, "Oh, Katie, look how many people loved you. Look how many people loved you." And I heard the first time, you know, I heard her voice, she said, "Yeah, well, where were they when they were supposed to be sending me money for college graduation?" And I knew it was her because I was, you know, I was in the mode of just being very sad and, you know, that. And then she, and that was Katie. That was her. So I knew I wasn't making it up.
Yeah, because that was her personality, and she was probably trying to lift your spirit a little bit. Let's go down the path of DNA. So, you know, you were talking about the funeral. It was a big outpour of love and support. You said it was hundreds of cards, right?
Yes. Oh, well, at one point I went back to see how many people had signed the guest book, you know, that you put out for a funeral, and there were over 1,200 people, which is amazing for our little town.
And talk to me about the town. How would you describe that area? And then also, what is happening? On one hand, you're planning your daughter's funeral and this worst thing that could happen in your life. But then on the other hand, it's unsolved. And you're probably having to deal with reporters like myself to try to keep the case out there and get answers. So talk to me about that time and how you're juggling it.
Well, at that point, my husband was very concerned about solving the case. At that point, I really wasn't. At that point, I was just grieving. I was grieving my daughter. I was trying to figure out how do you go on? You know, how do I do this? I mean, that's what I remember thinking. How do I do this? There were very few clues. There was very little evidence. There were no fingerprints. There were no witnesses. I mean, there was just almost nothing. But when they did the autopsy, they did find blood and skin under her fingernails because she really fought. And the detective in charge of her case told us that they had been able to get a complete DNA CODIS profile from that blood and skin, and it had been uploaded into the National Forensic DNA Database called CODIS. Now, at that time, I really knew nothing about CODIS. All I knew about DNA was what you see on Law & Order and CSI. And I thought, oh, we've got DNA, the case is solved. You know, we've got this DNA, the case is solved, no problem. And I just said to Captain Jones, I said, this man was such a horrible monster that he'll be arrested for something else and they'll swab his cheek and we'll have him. And that's when Captain Jones said, that's not how it works. It's illegal to take someone's DNA when they're arrested. And I literally felt like I'd been kicked in the stomach because I thought, what do you mean you can't use it? You know, we have this science. It's so accurate. It's so incredible. We take fingerprints when someone's arrested. We take their photographs when someone's arrested. We match fingerprints against, you know, unsolved crimes. We show people photographs to say, does this look like the person that attacked you or whatever? But we're not. I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. And that's what started the journey. This was probably about a month, 6 weeks after Katie had died. And he told us that we were very fortunate that they had gotten that crime scene evidence into CODIS so quickly. Because at that time, there was about a 2-year backlog in our crime lab. But the district attorney in Doniana County, who was Susana Martinez, who went on to become our governor later on, used her discretionary funds to send it to a private lab, get it analyzed and uploaded. And they got it uploaded within a matter of weeks. And the detective said, you know, we've run it through, no match. We don't have a match. They run it once a week. We'll run it once a week because people are coming into CODIS all the time. And hopefully we'll find a match.
So at that point, you're waiting, you know, it goes from days to weeks to months. And then what was it? Was it a phone call? Was it a knock at the door? When did you know that there was a break in the case?
It was 3 years and 3 months later. It was after we had gotten Katie's law passed in New Mexico. And, you know, I originally wanted that law passed to help find my daughter's killer. That was what I wanted originally. But from the time Katie was murdered until we started working on Katie's law was over 2 years. And during that time, I did so much research on the CODIS system, how it works, on DNA, what DNA is, how it works, on our criminal justice system, on, you know, the laws around the country. I'd done all this research, and I finally felt emotionally stable and intellectually ready to go try to get this law passed. So when we were in Santa Fe working so hard to get Katie's law passed in New Mexico, her murder still had not been solved. And the law passed in February of 2006, signed into law March 2006. And, you know, still nothing. And then my family started talking about, well, New Mexico was the sixth state to have this law. And we thought, that means there's 44 states that don't have it. Should we try to get this passed in other states? And we were talking about that. And we didn't know how to do it. I mean, in New Mexico, I went to my representative, said, hey, I have this idea. What do you think? He took it. He got a bill written. But how do you do it, you know, in Texas, where I'm not a resident? How do I do it in Rhode Island or South Carolina? So we just decided, and we decided in November of 2006 to write a letter to every state legislator in every state that didn't have the law. Tell them our story. Tell them we'd love to see this law passed, that we had just worked to get it passed in New Mexico. We'd like to help. And I told him, I'll never forget, I told my husband when we decided to do that, I said, I don't think Katie's case will be solved unless we do this. And he said, you mean you think it's going to be solved in another state? I said, I don't know what I mean, but I just feel like this is what we're supposed to do.
More than 3 years went by on the case and still no answers. Then a man by the name of Gabriel Avila was sent to prison on several charges, including burglary and resisting arrest. He was ordered to provide a DNA sample and was a match to Katie's killer. Avila confessed to the murder, saying that he ran into Katie by chance that night. He was driving down the road and nearly hit her, then followed her home where he attacked, raped, and strangled her.
The suspect in the case, who was arrested and convicted and did not dispute any of the charges, you know, that were against him, there was no plea bargain there, nothing. He was 27 years old. He was arrested for burglaries or something like that, and had there been DNA swabs in some of those, things might have been different.
He would have been identified less than 3 months after he killed Katie if we had had arrestee DNA testing in New Mexico at that time, because he broke into another home where two young girls were less than 3 months later and was caught, and they charged him with burglary. And, you know, if we had the opportunity and the legal standing to swab his cheek at that time, we would have identified him in 3 months instead of 3 years and 3 months. And I can tell you that makes a big difference to families.
You also had a conversation with him, at least one, right? Talk to me about that, what you're able to share in that. I know that you probably want to keep some of that private.
Susana Martinez called and said that he had asked to speak with us, and would we be willing to speak with him? And I said, I want to. Let me talk to my husband and my kids and see if they want to. And they said they did as well. I wanted to talk to him to try to find out why he would have done that to my daughter. My husband wanted to talk to him. He wanted to know what her last words were. And my son wanted to confront him and explain to him what he had taken, what Gabriel Avila had taken from my son, AJ. Caroline, our youngest daughter, she was 12 at the time, and she really didn't say much, but she wanted to be there with us. I'm very glad we had that opportunity. I'm really glad we had the opportunity to do that. He did ask for our forgiveness. At the time, I said, I don't know if I can. I'm going to try, but I don't know if I can. I have since forgiven him. Don't want him out of prison, but I have forgiven him. And I think that's an important thing for a family to have. I feel so fortunate. I mean, if you can say we're fortunate in this situation, we really are. We found our daughter quite quickly. You know, she wasn't missing for months or years or forever like some are. So we found her quickly. We were able to have a funeral. We were able to, you know, come together and grieve as a family. We know that we got the person that did it. We know that it is him. You know, we got justice. He's not going to hurt anyone else because he's in prison for the rest of his life. And then he asked us for forgiveness, and we were able to do that. So I think we've been very fortunate.
I know that in some of the news reporting, part of his excuse was drugs and whatnot. Has he been able to, after asking you for forgiveness, has he been able to change his life in any way? Has he found God? Has he done anything?
You know, Matt, I really don't know. And that's something that I've thought about that I want to find out. I really don't know. I'm a spiritual person and I do pray for him and I pray for his family.
You were going through the list of some of the questions that each of your family members and you had for him and why you wanted to speak with him. The listeners might wonder what some of those answers are. Are you able to share any of those?
Well, when I asked why he did it, he told me, you know, it was the drugs. That's what he told me. Why? And I said, why would you do this? And he said, I wasn't me. He said, I wasn't me. And then when my husband asked what were her last words, I think my husband was so afraid she would have been calling for him. And he wanted to know. And Avila said that she just kept asking, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? But he told us she fought hard. And he said she didn't seem to be afraid. She was surprised. But she didn't seem to be afraid. And that gave me a lot of comfort.
Thanks to Jay Ann and Dave Seppich, Katie's law requires anyone arrested on a violent crime to now submit a DNA sample. Had this law been in place sooner, Katie's killer would have been caught 3 months after her murder because he was arrested for aggravated burglary with a deadly weapon.
What is it that you would really like to share if you haven't already shared it?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, I think it's real important for people to understand that when we take this DNA profile and put it into CODIS, we're not putting their DNA into CODIS. You know, when you spit into the little tube and send it to Ancestry.com or 23andMe, you're sending your entire genome. I mean, it's everything. It's all 3 billion markers that tell everything about you. What goes into CODIS is only 20 markers, and it just goes in as a numerical entry. There's no genetic information in those 20 markers because they were specifically chosen by genetic scientists to protect privacy. But if those 20 numbers match, the chance that you have the wrong person is 1 in a number, a quintillion, which is a 1 followed by 18 zeros. So it's very, very accurate. Very accurate. And they've even developed a way to distinguish now between identical twins, because identical twins do have the same DNA. And in the past, if you got a match and that person was an identical twin, if, you know, unless one of them had an ironclad alibi and the other one didn't, they could just do this and you didn't know which one it was. Well, now science has gotten to the point that they can take, now not what goes into CODIS, not those 20 markers, but they can take their full genome, and you can do that now in less than 24 hours. And as you live your life, there's very slight modifications to your DNA, and they can tell which one it is for sure. So the science is just awesome. But I want people to understand that there's no invasion of privacy by CODIS. And also, that profile that goes into CODIS doesn't have a name. It has a specimen ID number that's only matched back to a name after there's a match to crime scene evidence. So if someone were to hack into CODIS, which no one's ever been able to do, but if they were, they would just get a series of numbers with no name attached. So they wouldn't, I mean, I actually put my DNA profile, my actual DNA profile on the back of my business card because I'm so certain you can't tell anything about me from that.
That's wonderful. I love your passion. I love that you understand how it works. I love that you really became educated on it on your own. I love this technology, and I really believe that it will help other people, and on both ways too, because, you know, there are people sitting behind bars that maybe admitted to a crime that they didn't do. And then that leaves, you know, a suspect out there to injure another person or worse.
We know of 3 cases where people were exonerated because of Katie's law, because they got that match and they were like, this person couldn't be guilty. To me, DNA is truth, and no one should be afraid of the truth.
Absolutely.
I know it's important. I've seen incredible results. In New Mexico, we've had over 1,500 cases solved as a direct result of Cady's Law. In California, they're getting 10 matches every day to their DNA database.
Today, Jay-Ann continues her fight for justice in helping other families. In 2008, she started DNA Saves, a nonprofit with a sole mission to educate the public about DNA testing.
Well, we have the remaining 19 states that have no sort of law, and then there are 18 of the states that have the full law, so we have those states that only have a partial law. We need to go back and get the full law. It's just a lot of work, but it really, really matters. And what really keeps me going is that I have become friends with mothers whose daughters would have been saved if this law had been in place in their state. I mean, we could track the timeline. For example, Brianna Dennison in Nevada, her mother, Bridget, worked with me when we passed the law in Nevada. And it took us, we started in 2007 trying to pass the law there, and it did not pass. Well, if it had passed in 2007, Brianna would still be alive, because the man that killed her raped two other women, left DNA evidence. That evidence was in CODIS. And then he was arrested for assault with a deadly weapon. But the woman he assaulted wouldn't help the prosecutor, so they dropped the case. They didn't have the law. They couldn't swab his cheek, so he was set free. And then later he went on to kidnap, rape, and murder Brianna. So Brianna would be alive if we had passed that law in 2007. We finally got it passed in 2013. In Nevada, it's called Brianna's Law, in memory of her. And so that's what keeps me going. This saves lives. It doesn't just solve crimes. It prevents future crimes. It saves lives. It keeps families from going through the experience that no one wants to go through. And so that's why it's so incredibly important.
The most amazing thing about my conversation with Jay-Ann is that she has no plans of slowing down the good fight anytime soon.
I get my perseverance from two places. First of all, Cady. She had more perseverance than anybody I've ever known in my life. And I think she's won't let me give up. And also, like I said, when I think of there are mothers out there whose daughters will be saved if we keep working on this. They'll never know what it's like to lose a daughter. And that, to me, is the reward.
I love that.
Now, if you would like to learn more about Cady's Law and DNASaves.org, I'll post a link in my show notes and my website, truecrimedeadline.com. You can find case photos and clips on social media, YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram under the podcast name True Crime Deadline as well. Investigators, stay well, stay safe. Until next time.
Thank you for investigating True Crime Deadline with Matt Johnson. For more information about the podcast, visit truecrimedeadline.com. And remember, all tips regarding a case should go to the police. Until next time.
Mr. Gatsby, want a cookie? Good boy.
Now, a post-episode shout-out to investigators who wrote reviews on Apple Podcasts. Thank you. Again, writing reviews really helps independent podcasts like this one get noticed. We're up against networks and studios and TV channels, so it really helps. It's easy. It's free. Just hit 5-star, subscribe, tell a friend, write a review, and include your real name and your podcast name. If you're a podcaster, you'll get a double shout-out. And if you write a review and you send me a screenshot of it to my website email address, I'll send you some free swag, some stickers. So the first one comes from Luke, who writes, "Excellent show, can't get enough, keep it coming." The next one from Jane, who writes, "Great true crime podcast. Just discovered the podcast. I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts, and this one has an interesting perspective. The creator is a working journalist. Plus, love anyone with a French bulldog." Well, Mr. Gatsby especially loves this review, and he says that most reviews should be written about him. Again, that's what he had to say. Okay. Until next time.